Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we will look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin in a moment and talk with a friend and colleague of Congresswoman Giffords, who, like her, has felt the ugly fury of the Tea Party up close and personal. Congressman Bob Filner joins us to recall the night when he was recently re-elected by a wide margin when his Tea Party opponent led a mob that besieged Congressman Filner's office on election night, cursing and threatening him in front of his terrified family, shouting Jew and traitor. We will speak about this as well as the president's speech last night that called for more civility in our political discourse. Then we'll be joined by Dr. Robert Edgar, the former six-term congressman, now the head of the nation's leading campaign finance reform organization, Common Cause. He was also the head of the National Council of Churches, so we'll ask him why House Speaker Boehner did not attend the memorial in Tucson, but instead was at a fundraiser, and whether the president can be both a political and a moral leader of a polarized country. Then we will be joined by presidential historian Alan Lichtman to examine the power and influence of presidential rhetoric and where Barack Obama's speeches stand in the pantheon of presidential addresses that have survived through the ages, even if at the time they were not appreciated or had little effect. Then finally, we will examine the political crisis in Lebanon following the collapse of the Lebanese government that happened while the president, whose father was allegedly murdered by Hezbollah, was visiting the White House. We'll be joined by Thanisis Cabanis, the author of A Privilege to Die, Inside Hezbollah's Legions and Their Endless War Against Israel. He has an article in today's New York Times, Hezbollah's Latest Suicide Mission. Congressman Filner, thank you so much for joining us today on Background Briefing.
Thank you. And, of course, we're still very concerned with Gabby Gifford's recovery. From all accounts, it's proceeding, but I think we still have to keep her in our thoughts and prayers.
Well, that was quite a moment last night where the president announced that she'd opened her eyes for the first time.
No question. She had her closest friends in Congress there, Senator Gillibrand and Debbie Wasserman Schultz from Florida. That's the speaker, the former speaker, Nancy Pelosi. So I think that those friends gave her an incredible, incredible lift.
Well, I know that the president, I think he did change the discourse, and I feel in a way a little off key talking about the Tea Party, but there's such a coordinated effort on the part of all of the right wing pundits, including Sarah Palin, to deny what they've said over the last couple of years. And I think it's time for them to man up, as Sharon Engel said to Harry Reid during the election debate.
The more they say, that they insist that there could be no connection between the wider climate and a deranged individual, and we can't excuse him, that itself is a political statement, because that enables them to absolve themselves of any responsibility here. And my point, not to keep an uncivil discourse going, but this cannot be seen, in my view, as an isolated incident. I mean, we had dozens of Congress people all over the country threatened. You saw some of the stuff that I went through election night and since.
Well, by the way, I had never seen that until I saw Don Lawrence O'Donnell's show last night. And it was truly scary and disgraceful and frightening.
Right. What occurred, by the way, is that, the Tea Party folks who had known for shouting people down in those health care debates, when I debated my opponent, they kept shouting me down so I couldn't talk. And then after it was announced that I was in the lead on election night, about 100 of them with their signs, and they were hitting my supporters, surrounded me. And I have been in mobs before. I have been active in the civil rights movement. I've been beaten up. I know the look of violence in people's eyes, and these people were intent on violence, as you could tell. They were screaming obscene things and making reference to the fact that I was Jewish. And I think if the police had not intervened, I could have been pretty well beaten up. But what occurred the next day, and then the day after Gabby's shooting, they said, look, politics obviously doesn't work because we had the better candidate and the better issues, and this sneaky guy must have defrauded us, so we have to move to violence. And they explicitly talked about my elimination. The day after Gabby's shooting, they said, well, the revolution has begun. We're going to get all these guys, and and we'll get Filner too. So they made explicit references, and this was going on not just in my contest and not just in Gabby's, but all over the country. It's a very terrifying thing that when a democracy literally is threatened like this.
Well, let me remind the audience, if I may. I'm speaking with Congressman Bob Filner, who represents California's 51st District, which includes much of southern San Diego, Chula Vista, National City, and all of Imperial County. In 1961, he participated in the Freedom Rides and spent 2 months in a Mississippi jail as a result. And on election night in November, he was confronted by an enraged group, including his opponent in that election, Nick Popadich. And one of the things that I think is unassailably true, and I wish somehow it could cut through, I'm getting letters saying that how dare you castigate Sarah Palin for putting targets on a map. They were surveyor's sign. All of this sort of mental gymnastics to avoid the obvious. No better authority to discuss that matter was the Congresswoman herself, who back in March went on television and castigated in a very dignified way Sarah Palin and said that what she's doing is dangerous and reckless and could have consequences. And that ought to be played around the clock on the media, in my opinion.
No question. And, Justice Holmes said 50, 60 years ago that, there are limits to free speech. You cannot yell fire in a crowded theater. And I say to Ms. Palin that you cannot yell, ready, aim, fire, in a crowded political situation. We must take responsibility for our words. And the talk show guys who say, hey, we're just talking. Well, why are they on the radio? They want to influence people. And as the sheriff of Pima County said, mentally disturbed or fragile people are the most influenced by this kind of talk. It legitimizes them. It empowers them. It says it's okay to think about violence. And whether you have Glenn Beck talking about killing Michael Moore, or you have Second Amendment remedies being talked, or in my case, AK-47s being brandished and snipers being shown how to do their work, you cannot deny responsibility for a climate that is become so harsh. And I think we all have to say, includes me and everybody, that we have to dial back. We have to take a deep breath, think about the effect of our words. Try to say, hey, the other guy or gal is not the demon or the enemy. They have different political views, and some mutual respect has got to be included there.
But Congressman Filner, do you feel, as I certainly do, and I'm on the left spectrum of the media, and frankly, we can't get arrested in commercial broadcasting. There's virtually no voices on the left in commercial broadcasting. But on the right, you've mentioned some of them, Beck, but there's Savage, Michael Savage, who has 8 million listeners and is one of the most poisonous human beings on the planet. Limbaugh, of course, has up to 20 million regular listeners who actually take political advice for him and vote his way. And of course, he's now saying that the assassin in Tucson is smiling because the Democrats are protecting him. I mean, some of the stuff is amazing, but why doesn't somebody go after the Rupert Murdochs of this world? It's like having an attack dog. The dog does what it does, but the owner is responsible for the dog.
Sure. And they're on 24 hours a day just about with, as you say, these millions of listeners. And somehow we've lost any semblance of fairness.
What is it, because of the fairness doctrine? I mean,
I think that's part of it. Here these guys actively promote, let's say, the Republican Party. And yet that's not that we should consider that a contribution to the party that comes under the under the FEC rules, and because they're making millions and millions of dollars worth of free advertising, and yet there's no limit on that. I think that has got to be looked at in terms of when they specifically and openly support a party or a candidate. Why isn't that considered contributions to that candidate and therefore subject to the limits that the law suggests.
So what is your explanation, Congressman Filner? When I looked at those faces of those people screaming at you on election night, and one of them was shouting Jew, and the others were, I mean, it's you don't even want to repeat what they were saying, but the level of venom and it was very disturbing, and I'm trying to understand. You know, I'm not suggesting it's because of the Beck and the right-wing echo chamber. It has to be a confluence of a lot of things. But why do these – and these look like pretty much kind of like working Americans.
Yeah, they think – you know, they are.
Well, why do they think a guy like you, who is on their side, is their enemy?
Well, you know, that's a good question. I think we all have to try to figure out an answer. The answer that I have – historically, at tough times economically, the worst parts of Americans come out, and there's always a look for scapegoats. There's racism that's heightened, and we are at a very vulnerable economic time. These people are afraid. They don't have good jobs. They don't have health care. They don't have pensions, and they look and the people that they're listening to find the scapegoats. The scapegoats are the immigrants or the gays or Democrats, and yet there's a underlying racism there, I think, that says to them, hey, you got one thing going for you, you're white, which, you know, it puts a whole level of venom in there. When they say they're losing their country, I think they say they want to take back their country. It's from those people of color who have increasing rights in our society. So I think partially it comes from that. People are scared, they're fragile, and they take simplistic answers for the problems that they have. And the Democrats, I think, have been very weak in trying to answer this. That is, we are timid, we think everybody's moved to the right, we're afraid to confront it directly and say, we have some answers, and to put it in a way that these folks can understand. They really think that the country is being lost from the way they've had it, rather than to say, hey, you can participate in a much more vibrant, dynamic, multicultural future for our nation, and everybody can have a part in this. We don't glorify that, and they demonize it. And when all of government is demonized, they look at people like me, a elected official, that I am the enemy. They have Russia and those guys have so delegitimized public service that they could see us as the demons of the world.
Well, President Obama's words last night, reciting what the young girl who was killed, what she said and her belief in government service and calling upon all of us to try and make the country live up to this young girl's expectations was very appropriate. But
I thought that was the best line, excuse me, in the speech when he said we have to live up to the expectations of our children.
But just in closing, Congressman Filner, there is others have identified an authoritarian streak in the Republican Party. John Dean and Barry Goldwater Jr. wrote a book about it. I'm concerned about a kind of totalitarian streak and when you have the leader of the Senate, Mitch McConnell, literally calling for the not the physical destruction of Obama, but the destruction of his presidency, and his number one priority is to make sure he doesn't get reelected. It has a kind of Stalinist feel to it, and frankly, what they're doing now with this effort to split the working Americans between those in the private sector who've lost their jobs, lost their pension, and lost their health care, with state employees who are in states that have suffered enormous revenue collapses because of what happened on Wall Street, not because of profligate spending, yet they're being demonized. And it seems to be an effort to break the public employees' unions because they support the Democratic Party. So I'm wondering if you've got Fox as your Pravda and you've got Republican leaders determined to just you know, take no prisoners and crush the Democrats or you know, whatever, then to me, this is a totalitarian one-party impulse.
I mean, I would compare it to, you know, Germany in the early 30s when Hitler, remember, came to power legally at first. And, you know, these kind of he played on their fears and inflation and the economic uncertainty and found a scapegoat in the Jews. And people followed him. And we're dangerously close to that if you look at the kinds of things that are going on. So, you know, I call upon not only, you know, the Republican leaders to say to these folks, hey, you've gone too far, and we've got to step back and work on this in a new way.
Well, Senator Udall is suggesting that at this upcoming State of the Union that the Democrats and the Republicans mix up their seating so that we'll see how that goes.
I'd be careful about knives there then.
I thank you for joining us here today in Los Angeles, Congressman Bob Filner.
Thank you for bringing up these issues. It's very important.
Thank you. Again, I was speaking then with Congressman Bob Filner, who represents California's 51st District, which includes much of southern San Diego, Chula Vista National City, and all of Imperial County. In 1961, he participated in the Freedom Rides and spent 2 months in a Mississippi jail as a result. And as he was saying on election night back in November, he was confronted by an enraged group of the Tea Party, including his opponent in that election, led by his opponent in that election, Nick Popovich. I'm now speaking with Bob Edgar. Dr. Bob Edgar is the president and CEO of Common Cause. He was elected to the U.S. House of Representatives in 1974 as part of the congressional class nicknamed the Watergate Babies, those elected in the wake of the Watergate scandal and who led sweeping reforms of Congress. Bob ran unsuccessfully for the U.S. Senate in 1986 against Arlen Specter, and that race fueled his frustration with the undue influence of money in politics. He became an active supporter of clean elections and campaign finance reform. So let me ask you, Dr. Edgar, just at the top here, what I was struck by, and I'm sure you found the memorial last night very moving, and the president's speech was, I think, quite extraordinary. But what I have learned since is, and I wondered why the Speaker of the House, John Boehner, wasn't there. And then I found out today that he wasn't there because he was at a fundraiser. And I'm just astounded to learn that.
I share your astonishment. I was pleased with Speaker Boehner last Saturday when he said an attack on one member of the House is an attack on all. And his response to the tragedy in Tucson was very positive up till yesterday, but I find it very strange that the new Speaker of the House of Representatives chose to stay in Washington. He did use an excuse that he had organized a prayer vigil and the Air Force One took off before the end of that prayer vigil in the House, but it was clear that the government of the United States, and in fact the president's plane fleet, is such that the Speaker of the House could have commandeered an airplane and been side by side with not only the president but John McCain and others, respecting the horrific nature of this tragedy. So it was a surprise, and I think it was unfortunate on the part of the leader of the House not to fully participate.
And he was at a fundraiser, though, as well as the prayer.
That's correct. And I think at a fundraiser points out the fact that the leadership on both sides have warned new members of Congress that they should spend 20, 30 hours a week raising money for their reelections. We've seen with Citizens United case coming down from the Supreme Court, giving corporations and labor unions the ability to dip into their corporate treasuries, that there's been a huge growth in the amount of money spent on campaigns, and money is corroding the system.
Well, I think this, you can clearly now, in retrospect from the last elections, you can make the linkage between Citizens United's Supreme Court decision and the enormous success of the Republicans, because they got most of the money from these invisible groups that weren't required to reveal who the big donors were, and they spend it very strategically, and they got their results.
Well, in the last 4 years, 70% of the legislation going through the Senate has been blocked by a handful of senators with the use of the filibuster as an obstruction. And the bill that would have forced more disclosure, called Disclose, passed the Senate by 59 votes in the Senate, but did not pass because it didn't have the 60 supermajority votes needed to get it passed. Mm-hmm. Citizens United is going to have a negative impact even further in the 2012 election. Suppose there's a rogue corporation or a super wealthy individual who dislikes the incumbent president or dislikes one of the candidates running for either party for president. They can now, given that Supreme Court decision, simply put down $1 billion at the start of a presidential race and influence completely the outcome of the race. And in House districts, 5 million, 10 million can be put in to defeat candidates who voted for the health care bill or voted against something that a corporation or a large individual didn't want. Bill Moyers is a friend of mine, and Bill came to the 40th anniversary of Common Cause back in October, and as president of Common Cause, we were honored to have him there. And he indicated in his speech, and later to me privately, that he thinks this is the most dangerous time in American history, where democracy is really threatened. It's threatened not only by the harsh hate speech rhetoric that many politicians are now using, but even further, it's impacted by the corrosive nature of money in politics and the fact that at the end of reform, there'll be lobbyists, but currently money is more important than the talking points of those lobbyists, and we're just moving closer to having corporate America dictate our policies. The rich are getting richer, the poor are getting poorer. The new chair of the board at Common Cause is a guy by the name of Robert Reich, who is Labor Secretary. He wrote a book called Aftershock, where he points out that shortly before the Depression, the rich were getting richer and the poor were getting poorer. And he pointed the comparison to our own time, where it's exponentially, hugely separated from the wealthy and the corporate leaders and the rank and file. And that's a very dangerous sign moving forward in terms of economic distress.
Let me remind this audience, I'm speaking with the president and CEO of Common Cause, Bob Edgar, who served 11 years in the United States Congress. And the Citizens United vote, by the way, the reason that I understand that Justice Kennedy voted with the hard right four, the very conservative four, is that he thought that there would be disclosure, and it turned out that there isn't disclosure. And I know Kennedy actually showed up last night at the memorial, but it feels like Kennedy got snookered by the more ideological ultra-right conservatives on the court, who I think I don't know where they're. Political partisanship ends and their judicial reasoning begins. But let's get back to the main subject here, if I can, Dr.
Well, actually, I think the Citizens United is part of the main subject.
Yeah.
Had Sandra Day O'Connor still been in the courts, the decision would have been 5-4 the other direction.
Right.
And it's clear that both Sandra Day O'Connor and Justice Stevens think that it's one of the worst decisions that the court has made, and no one that I know of in either political party thought that corporations and labor unions did not have voice before last January 21st when the Supreme Court decision came down. And I think it's just another tool in the tool chest of ultra-conservative political folk and wealthy folk who are working hard to take back or take over the government of the United States and the political system. Every speech I give, either to a secular audience or a religious audience today, I get them to quote, "We are the leaders we've been waiting for." Mm-hmm. I think last night at the memorial service, the president was catching some of that tone and saying, even a 9-year-old child can lead us in a new direction. And my prayerful hope is that the good that will come out of the tragedy will be a tempering down of hate speech and offensive speech, and the Democrats and Republicans will find a way to really make this a people and by the people.
Well, I just wonder, though, that whether, in spite of the wonderful rhetoric and the powerful sentiment and the exhibition that Barack Obama is both a political leader and a moral leader, and the country clearly desperately needs leadership in both directions. Nevertheless, we mentioned that while this was all happening, John Boehner was at a fundraiser. Now, he's the new head of the House. He says that when he assumed the head of the 112th Congress, that they're going to give the government back to the American people. And there was an op-ed recently, an editorial recently in the New York Times describing Boehner's House of Representatives as the corporate house, and was suggesting that it was clear, particularly because of the memo that Darrell Issa sent out to 150 business and trade groups soliciting their input on how to get rid of regulations, that this was going to be the Republicans' real plan is to serve their corporate masters. So just give us finally a sense of whether the kind of moral leadership and lofty rhetoric that the president exhibited last night makes any difference in the town that you work in on a daily basis, Dr. Edgar, trying to clean up Dodge and get money out of politics.
Well, let me first say something about Congressman Issa's letter to 150 corporations. It really smacked of the same kind of thing that Vice President Cheney did when he brought the energy companies in to write the environmental energy legislation in the former Bush administration. It's insider trading and then some. And the thought of a congressman asking corporations what regulations you want reduced, think about Love Canal. What would we have said to those corporations? Tell us how you can reduce the regulations so you can spread the toxic substances that were exposed at Love Canal. I think that's a tragedy. Now, on your point, I think that the president's speech is one baby step in the right direction. I think that perhaps Leader Boehner might be embarrassed enough because of going to a fundraiser rather than to the memorial service. Maybe he'd listen to some of us who have suggested that the Democrats and Republicans go together on retreat. I don't think just sitting together at a State of the Union is the way to do it, but I do think there's been too much this side versus that side. When I served in Congress, we had a whole host of Republicans that once elected worked with the Democrats, and we were often fighting conservative Democrats more than we were fighting people like Jake Javits in New York or Senator Brooks from Massachusetts or Hines and Swiker from Pennsylvania. There were Republicans and Democrats who said, how do we solve the problems of our nation? And we're not going to have a very strong nation moving forward unless the House and Senate find ways to think carefully and collaboratively about the enormous problems that we face. And last night was a baby step in the right direction.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here on Background Briefing, Dr. Bob Edgar.
It's good to be with you. People can ask me questions at our website or just emailing me at redgar@commoncause.org.
Well, thank you again, Dr. Edgar. I've been speaking with Bob Edgar, who is the president and CEO of Common Cause. He was elected to the United States House of Representatives in 1974 as part of the congressional class nicknamed the Watergate Babies, those elected in the wake of the Watergate scandal and who led the sweeping reforms of the Congress. He served, of course, for six terms in the Congress and was also formerly the head of the National Council of Churches. Let's take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking with the presidential historian about whether or not a president can be both a political and a moral leader. And welcome back to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and I'm speaking with Alan Lichtman, who is a professor of history at American University. He has studied both the American right and the presidency. His books include White Protestant Nation, The Rise of the American Conservative Movement, and The Keys to the White House, A Surefire Way to Predicting the Next President. His prediction system has correctly predicted the outcomes of all presidential elections since 1984. Thank you for joining us, Alan Lichtman.
My pleasure.
And Professor Lichtman, I wish you could have heard our first guest, Congressman Bob Filner, who was describing what happened on the night that he was re-elected recently by a considerable margin. His offices were stormed by his Tea Party opponent, who beat up his staff, surrounded him.
Wow.
They cursed and screamed, called him a Jew and a traitor. Terrified his family. The reason I spoke to him was I saw the footage last night on MSNBC on Lawrence O'Donnell's new show, and it was so chilling. And it reminds me, of course, of so much of what happened with Congresswoman Giffords, who, when her father was asked after the tragedy, who were her enemies, and her father said the whole Tea Party.
It's truly sad that politics should come to this. But I hate to say there is a whole tradition of this. The Tea Party did not spring full-blown out of nothingness. You can go back to the Ku Klux Klan movement of the 1920s, which was virulently anti-Semitic, of course, anti-Catholic, anti-black, anti-foreign, but also, like the Tea Party, had a major political operation. It elected thousands of local officials. It elected a number of senators, a number of governors. It declined rather precipitously, but it also was trying to hearken back to an older, more homogeneous vision of America, hence, of course, the reference to the Tea Party. That's not merely anti-tax. That's also a reference, of course, to the pioneer generation and a very different kind of America. And you could chase this through the McCarthy movement of the 1950s that caused so many people to lose their jobs or otherwise be demonized in the anti-communist frenzy of that period. And by the way, there is a history to this crosshairs that nobody has mentioned. You know, Sarah Palin's aides talk about it being a surveyor mark. Nonsense. This image had been used before to target congressmen in the 1960s by the Minutemen, an armed radical militia group that took congressmen that they felt were not sufficiently anti-communist and put crosshairs on them and said, beware, the crosshairs are upon you. So this is nothing new. And in choosing Sarah Palin, in choosing the term blood libel, that was utterly beyond belief. Of course, the tradition of the blood libel is that this is an old myth dating back to the Middle Ages, that Jews ritually slaughtered Christian children and drank their blood as part of their holiday rituals. There was a blood libel like this in America in the 1920s. Blood libels have been used to justify brutalization and discrimination against Jews. They were part of the Nazi philosophy. And to use this term at this time either, to me, signifies monumental ignorance or monumental hubris.
Well, Professor Alan Lichtman, it seems, though, that in contrast with Sarah Palin's speech on Facebook, which was obviously well produced and timed, the morning and then in the evening, the president's speech at the memorial. To me, it was night and day. I mean, she was so small and petty, and he was so uplifting and calling upon us all to be better and to recall the better angels of our nature. Do you think it's possible for a president to be both a moral and a political leader?
Before I answer that, let me say I agree with you about the speech. And this speech harkens back to two earlier speeches of Barack Obama, his 2004 speech before the Democratic Convention that kind of introduced himself as an inspirational
politician who, as an African American, could speak to America as a whole and his extraordinary 2008 disquisition on race. In this speech, he did what you have to do as a president. He helped us grieve. He evoked our common bonds, and he inspired us to something beyond ourselves. And, you know, that kind of magic had been missing, and it now seems to be back for Obama. Of course a president can be both a moral and a political leader, and our greatest presidents have been both. Abraham Lincoln was a supreme politician, one of the founders of America's new party, the Republican Party, founded 8 years before he was elected president. And yet, of course, he was a deeply introspective, moral man who was really the first president in a forthright way to confront the evils and sins of slavery. Franklin Roosevelt, a Democrat, of course. Lincoln was a Republican, was another extraordinarily shrewd and hard-nosed, practical politician. Yet at the same time, he was a great moral leader who led us through perhaps our greatest economic challenge and our greatest wartime challenge abroad. And, you know, Franklin Roosevelt also dealt with the Holocaust, which was a very difficult thing for a president to deal with in the midst of a depression and the midst of a world war. And you can see both all these priorities tugging on him as he threads his way through these very difficult moral choices. All moral choices are difficult. They all require trade-offs. They all require sacrifices. They all require some use of resources. And the test of a great president is, can you, like a Lincoln or a Roosevelt, thread your way through all this and still be an inspiration, still accomplish things, and yet at the same time, you know, recognize that you're also the head of your party and a politician?
Well, Professor Lichtman, I got this reaction from watching all of the speeches that day, starting with Palin and then ending with the president, and thinking about it, because I've been talking with a lot of people in Tucson ever since it happened, and frankly, the most powerful speech I ever saw in regard to this came from the very victim herself, who back in March, when her office was vandalized because of her vote on health care, she castigated in a very dignified way Sarah Palin for putting a target on her, both literally and figuratively, and warned Sarah Palin that there could be consequences. So it was very sad and prescient to see this. But the feeling I get is that America seems to me in many ways divided between, if you will, the dark side and the light side. And the president was all last night trying to bring us into the light, and this tortured kid that shot her and all those people represents the dark side. And I, you know, I'm not trying to conflate the kid with the Tea Party, because there's, you know, that's,
you can't do that.
That's stupid. And but even though the right wing is accusing the so-called liberal press of doing it, it just is not happening. But I do feel that the Tea Party and their activities do represent the dark side. And Palin, she was so small and petty, and Obama, by contrast, was so lofty and impressive. I just wonder whether, you know, the better angels can transcend this economic depression, and in 2012, we get the right results.
I think they can. I think America is beginning to see Sarah Palin for what she is, both ignorant and mean-spirited, and that's a very dangerous combination. Either she used the term blood libel out of sheer ignorance or out of tremendous malice, and either one, it doesn't figure well upon her. I think her approval ratings, which weren't all that impressive to start with, are going to go down in the wake of her response to this tragedy, and those of the president who really, as you said, stood above the partisan strife and appealed to what is the better angels of our nature and to what we have in common, his approval ratings are going to go up. I, as you say, have a book called The Keys to the White House, which has predicted every election since 1984, and well over a year ago, taking into account expected Democratic losses in the midterms of 2010, I predicted a relatively easy re-election victory for Barack Obama, and the keys still point very much in that direction. I think Sarah Palin is most unlikely to be nominated by the Republican Party, and if she does get the nomination, she'll be another Barry Goldwater, 39% to 40% of the vote.
Well, she's clearly running, I think, I think that was what the timing of that her video was all about, as well as suggesting that she's ignorant, which I think is fairly clear. The people that write her speeches, I believe they're these neocons that are, you know, Bill Kristol and company and the former advisor to National Security Advisor John McCain's campaign, Randy Scheunemann. They're her inner circle. I was amused to see one of the responses from the former political advisor to Senator John McCain in Arizona, John Weaver, on his Facebook. The president had exactly the right tone and was pitch perfect for the nation last night. And when juxtaposed against, well, you know who, ahem. So there you have it.
Remarkable. And, you know, in some senses, this was even a better speech than Bill Clinton's 1995 speech in the wake of the Oklahoma City bombing. But that speech was a turning and pivotal moment for Bill Clinton and the nation. We had a very similar situation. Republicans had just taken over, in this case, both houses of the Congress. The kind of Sarah Palin figure, although vastly smarter and shrewder of the time, was Newt Gingrich, who was at the time, you know, very radical, a young Turk, leading a new Republican revolution. There was a lot of rhetoric coming from Rush Limbaugh and G. Gordon Liddy and other talk show hosts that was bordering on incitement to violence. People were talking about Bill Clinton being a one-term president. He had a plead even to say the president is relevant. And there were other factors as well, but that speech at Oklahoma City, I think, was really a turning point for Bill Clinton and the nation.
So, Professor Alan Lichtman, as a presidential historian, how does Obama compare in the kind of in terms of presidential rhetoric? How does his speeches stand in the pantheon of presidential addresses? And as I mentioned in the opening of the program today, some have survived through the ages. Even at the time, they weren't appreciated or had little effect.
Correct.
I recall, for example, Gettysburg's address. Yeah.
Exactly. I would have given him relatively mediocre marks prior to this speech because I thought his two greatest speeches were pre-presidential, the 2004 Democratic Convention speech and the 2008 speech on race. I did not think his inaugural address belonged in the pantheon of great inaugural addresses like Franklin Roosevelt's first inaugural or John Kennedy's inaugural. And I wasn't all that impressed with other speeches as well. But this one, I think, elevates him, at least in terms of one speech, among the most magical and persuasive of our presidents. But he'll need to do more to be in the company of a Lincoln or a Roosevelt or a John F. Kennedy.
So just in closing, Alan Lichtman, do you think that the tide that is being driven by money, because clearly the Supreme Court decision made enormous difference in these midterm elections to fuel this Republican takeover of the House and increase their majority in the Senate, and you know, a billionaire, as our previous guest Bob Edgar, head of Common Core, said, you know, a billionaire can put $1 billion up to defeat the Democratic candidate if he wants to next time around.
Well, that's certainly true. And in fact, I have said for many years, if you want to get rich in America, don't dig for gold, don't drill for oil, make political contributions. In return for hundreds of thousands or millions in political contributions, these business groups can get billions in benefits and tax breaks. And sadly, it's not just Republicans. I'm no big Ralph Nader fan in terms of his campaigns, but he has a point when he says both parties are beholden to corporate interests. Let's not forget, the Democrats had the House, they had the Senate, they had the President for 2 years, and they could not even confront what I think is perhaps humanity's most daunting challenge, and that is getting off the fossil fuel economy. Yes, for global warming, but also for national security, also for the environment, also for the economy. This is perhaps our most urgent task, and the best the Democrats could come up with was a pathetic cap-and-trade bill, which had failed in Europe, and they couldn't even get the Senate approval for that. So I would not, unfortunately, limit the influence of corporations and corporate lobbies and corporate monies just to one part of it. They have our whole government tied up, and you know that I think is one of the biggest problems we have in this country. And given these Supreme Court decisions and the composition of the court, and there's no easy solution to it, and we're not going to get complete public financing.
Well, I thank you for joining us today in Los Angeles, Professor Alan Lichtman.
Anytime. Take care.
Thank you. I've been speaking with Alan Lichtman, who's a professor of history at the American University. He studied both the American right and the presidency. His books include White Protestant Nation, The Rise of the American Conservative Movement, and The Keys to the White House, a surefire way to predicting the next president. His prediction system has correctly predicted the outcomes of all U.S. presidential elections since 1984. I'm now speaking, we're going to turn now from the president's speech and domestic politics and examine the current situation in Lebanon, where the government has just fallen. I'm speaking with Thanasis Kambanis, who is author of A Privilege to Die, Inside Hezbollah's Legions and Their Endless War Against Israel. He was the Boston Globe Middle East bureau chief and is now a freelance journalist writing regularly for the New York Times and other publications. He also teaches journalism and foreign policy at Columbia University School of International and Public Affairs. And he has an op-ed in today's New York Times called Hezbollah's Latest Suicide Mission. Thank you for joining us here on Background Briefing, Thanasis Kambanis.
Pleasure to be with you.
And in terms of a suicide mission, of course, the timing was fairly obvious that the president of Lebanon is visiting the White House, and as it happened, ironically, it was his father who was killed by a bomb, a massive bomb, back I think in the summer of 2006. And at the same time, while he's meeting with the president, and the United Nations Tribunal is closing in on a decision which is alleged to be that Hezbollah was behind the bombing, Hezbollah pulls the plug on the government. You have written about this, but does this mean civil war, or is this just as kind of a bluff?
Well, the way I would call it more a hostage taking than a suicide mission. In this case, Hezbollah has taken the Lebanese state hostage. And what they're saying is, or if you want another violent metaphor, you could say they're putting a gun to the head of the Lebanese state. Either way, they're saying if this tribunal goes forward, we will destroy the state of Lebanon and make sure none of our fighters are invited and put on trial. And they're giving a pretty clear choice. It's an unpleasant choice, but it's a clear choice. They're saying, back down, and we'll allow the fiction of the Lebanese state to continue, and we'll continue collaborating with Saad Hariri, the son of the murdered prime minister. And you're right in identifying this as in some ways an incremental step, because we're still a long way from civil war. Most recently, in May 2008, Hezbollah actually invaded Sunni West Beirut for one day in order to show how far they were willing to go in order to achieve their political aims. And even then, they held back from an all out war because they don't want to destroy what they govern if they don't have to.
Well, this showdown. Exercised or that shows Hezbollah's muscle. I mean, everybody that I talk to that's been to Beirut recently or to Lebanon recently say it's pretty clear that Hezbollah runs the place. It was preceded by an attempt to broker a deal between Saudi Arabia and Syria, trying to strike some kind of compromise. But it really comes down to whether or not Hariri's son, the current president, can stomach the idea of letting his father's killers off the hook. And if he does so, he will have no credibility.
Yeah, and this is Lebanon, right, where people are always willing to compromise to some extent. And the real question is always how much. So Rafiq Hariri was murdered in 2005, almost 5.5 years ago. His son is now the prime minister, and he has actually already signaled a willingness to back down on this, right? I mean, the question of pursuing his father's killers, the sort of Oedipal drama, is already tainted by the fact that he's signaled that he was willing to accept some small fry. I mean, he met with Hassan Nasrallah, the head of Hezbollah, and he said in a meeting whose details were then revealed and haven't been disputed, he said, if you're willing to let a few low-level operatives be fingered for this crime, I will stop short of accusing Hezbollah as a party of being behind it. And Hezbollah said, no, we won't take that deal. We won't even give up the lowest-level street lieutenant to this. We'll fight you tooth and nail. And the other complicating factor is Hezbollah is the dominant player in Lebanon, but they don't control everything. They control the Shia areas, and they're by far the strongest party, but they don't control the Christian areas, the Sunni areas. So it's always a very delicate balancing act because we don't know exactly how strong they are beyond their own areas.
But again, I'm speaking with Thanasi Kambanis, the author of A Privilege to Die Inside Hezbollah's Legions and Their Endless War Against Israel. And he also has an op-ed in the New York Times called Hezbollah's Latest Suicide Mission. Hezbollah basically says to the Arab, because they, as your article points out, they present themselves as the true sole protectors of Arab dignity from the humiliations of Israel and the United States. And they continually, as they've done today, and they will do tomorrow, saying that that Hariri and company are tools of Washington. He was, after all, in Washington when they pulled the plug. Now he's visiting with Sarkozy in France, the former colonial master. On the other side, the more secular and Sunni Lebanese say that Hezbollah are tools of Iran and Syria. So in this kind of standoff, is there any kind of sectarian flexibility here in terms of people's hearts and minds? I mean, can't they see the obvious? I mean, or are they so polarized?
Well, they're polarized politically. Now, on the sectarian front, there's room for hope. I mean, Hezbollah, they're the Islamic resistance. They're sworn to the perpetual war against Israel. Their biggest allies are a Christian party. They have the biggest Druze party on their side, and they have some small Sunni parties on their side as well. So they make a passably credible case of being a sort of unified cross-sectarian coalition against Israel and against the West. And I think if there's a silver lining to be had, it's that they will they'll appeal to Lebanese nationalism and to some kind of hey, if we can agree on one thing, it's that we all hate Israel, and then maybe even Hariri will find a political solution in that, in which he'll say, you know what, my father's real killers were in Syria anyway, so it doesn't matter who pulled the trigger, and since the political guilty parties aren't going to be held responsible, I too can live with some kind of unseemly, dirty compromise, and then we can all sort of go back to being sort of vociferous Lebanese nationalists.
But why, if the findings that have been leaked are correct, and the UN tribunal will, if assuming that that Hariri, the current president, doesn't make a compromise and somehow bag the information, what was the motive of doing it in the first place? Why?
I'm not satisfied with the explanations I've heard so far, because even if Hezbollah operatives pulled the trigger or put together the bombing, so to speak, it doesn't really make sense. They don't have a great motive. I mean, Rafiq Hariri was a good, a decent supporter of Hezbollah. I mean, he never stood in Hezbollah's way directly. And so it doesn't really make sense that they would try to kill him. Now, the only explanation I've heard that makes sense is that Syria wanted Hariri dead, and they pressured Hezbollah to because the Hezbollah had the technical capacity to pull it off, that they pressured Hezbollah to do it. I don't know that to be a fact. That's the only one of the many theories I've heard that even makes the remotest sense. The real motive lies with Syria's leadership. So the only party that has an obvious motive, and now, of course, people in Hezbollah point to Israel and say Israel has a motive to destabilize Lebanon. But, you know, that to me that strains credulity because if, let's just entertain the idea, if Israel were behind this, why would they only kill people on one side of the political divide? And every one of the assassinations that began in 2005 was from the anti-Syrian pro-March 14th coalition. Mm.
Well, there is, I believe, in this mix the possibility that the Michel Aoun, the Christian leader who is supporting Hezbollah, that he's making a run for Hariri's job. So,
he doesn't want Hariri's job. He wants to be the president.
The president, I mean.
He wants Suleiman's job.
Yeah, that's right. He wants the president's job. Well, look, let's not even go there, given the Byzantine politics of Lebanon. But thank you for joining us here for your piece today in the New York Times, which I found very interesting, Hezbollah's latest suicide mission, and for your book, Thanasi Kambanis, A Privilege to Die, Inside Hezbollah's Lessons, Legions and Their Endless War Against Israel.
Great to talk to you.
Bye-bye. And hello again, I'm Ian Marcel, just speaking there with Thanasi Kambanis, who's the author of the book that I just mentioned. He has an article in the New York Times. I'd like to thank producer Spencer Downing, engineer Ray Palias, and I'll be back on Sunday with another background briefing at 11 a.m. on Sunday. And until then, have a very pleasant couple of days and be better, as the president says. Just when everything seemed right, another headline.